the man who started Monarch Watch. He's the founder and director, Chip Taylor. Chip, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but I hope you're cooler up there than we are down here.
We are, although it's supposed to get into the 90s today. What kind of weather are you talking about? And you're talking about Kansas?
I'm talking about Kansas, and it looks like we're going to hit 99 to 100 again today.
Yikes. How much of that have you had lately?
It's really been a fairly moderate summer here, but the last few days have gotten a little bit serious.
Yeah, it's weird how I was just talking with my meteorologist, Rick DeMaio, in the 9 o'clock hour. In Chicago, we're going to probably have our first two back-to-back 90-degree days today and tomorrow for the summer.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been odd. It's just been really cool. We keep getting the cool weather that dips down from Canada in this part of the country, and even while other areas of the country, perhaps Kansas, get some heat. Although, in general, we haven't had the nasty heat and drought in the middle of the country that we've had for the last several years.
No, it's been better here, too.
Yeah, and that's actually a good place to start, because you watch that in terms of how it affects the monarch population. And by the way, if folks, I'm interested in your questions at 773-763-9278. If you've been observing monarchs in the Chicago area or anywhere in the country, if you're listening elsewhere, give us a call or post on Facebook or on Twitter. Or send me an email, mike@mikenovak.net. But the drought and heat have been a real issue with monarchs. Now, I was looking at a couple of the posts that you have done on Monarch Watch. And earlier this year, when we had that, there was a conference at the Chicago Botanic Garden about monarchs where you spoke, and I saw you there. In preparation for that, I did a post on my own website, and I quoted a Washington Post article about the monarch crisis. And for folks who are new to this and you've been on Mars for a couple of years, our monarchs are in trouble, at least they have been for the last couple of years or several years. And the Washington Post article pointed out three reasons for the decline in monarch butterflies in North America, and their list was deforestation in Mexico, recent bouts of severe weather that I just talked about, the drought and heat, and the growth of herbicide-based agriculture destroying crucial milkweed flora in the Midwest. However, then you wrote recently, your top three, it's not quite the same. You say, in the order, the adoption of herbicide-tolerant crops, the ethanol mandate, and development or habitat loss. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, yes. Looking at the total picture here, one of the things that's striking about almost every animal that's in decline, every animal, and that includes insects that are in decline, has to do with habitat. So we have to look at habitat first, and we have to ask if, is the habitat stable? For a long time, in the early part of the work that we were doing with monarchs, it appeared that the habitat was relatively stable. And then starting with the adoption of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, and then followed by the ethanol mandate, we began to see a tremendous loss of habitat. And, of course, we have habitat loss due to development on a scale of about 6,000 acres a day in this country. And that nibbles away at all of the support that this population has. And it's not just monarchs that are living in these areas that are being developed or being used for cropping, but it's all the other species as well. So when we're losing monarchs, we're losing a lot of other things. And that's of great concern. Monarchs are simply that kind of a surrogate for a larger issue here in terms of habitat loss.
Or the canary in the coal mine or something like that. But okay, give me that figure again. What, 6,000 acres a day you say we're losing in habitat?
Yeah. Yeah, 6,000 acres a day is what we're losing in habitat. That's about 2.2 million acres per year, and that's a very significant loss of habitat. But that's not the really big thing that's been going on. That's of the three, that's certainly the minor one. Just consider this: when the ethanol mandate came about, signed by President Bush at the end of 2007, immediately the farmers began to look for where they could plant more corn, because it was obvious that the price of corn was going to go up, and it did. And so what we had was a consumption of a lot of habitat to convert to cropland very shortly after the signing of the ethanol mandate, to the extent that 24 million acres of habitat were converted to croplands in 5 years. Now, 24 million acres it's hard to fathom. It's hard to figure out, you know, just get wrapped your mind about how big an area that is. But it's as big as the state of Indiana. So in 5 years, we've lost a large amount of habitat. And that's been significant because it's had an effect on a lot of other things as well. I mean, the pheasant hunters throughout the Midwest have had a real problem with this because pheasant populations, which were being produced in those habitats, have gone way down. So pheasant populations have declined in six Midwestern states. And the people who are relying on pheasant hunting as a way of earning a living from running motels and running restaurants and so on and so forth in the Midwest are hurting a little bit because of this ethanol mandate.
Well, you mentioned that other species are going to be affected by this. I think it bears repeating. You just said that 24 million acres, or basically land the size of the state of Indiana, was converted to cropland in 5 years. Now, you're familiar with Doug Tallamy's work, and that's the alarm he keeps sounding, that we're just losing so much habitat that we can't sustain this, and he's right now concerned about insect biomass, obviously monarch butterfly being part of that. But from what I understand, the Obama administration is still on board with the ethanol program. What's the story on that?
Well, this is an issue that has to be settled with Congress. I mean, Congress created the ethanol mandate, and Congress has to put the brakes on. EPA has started or has attempted to put the brakes on, and there have been howls of protest that you can't do this. And, you know, you have to give it to the farmers because, you know, they have a right to make a living, and they have a right to make a living off their land. And this is, in some sense, not their problem. What we really have to understand is whether ethanol is a good thing or a bad thing in the long run in terms of how to use our landscape. Are we really getting an energy benefit from ethanol? And there are a lot of people who think we're not. So that's another issue altogether. But I can tell you that the Obama administration is very much on the pollinator side of things. The president produced a memo, presidential memo, and on the 20th of June this year, in which he commanded that all federal agencies get on board with pollinator conservation. So any federal agency that has anything to do with landscape or anything to do with land management or management of wildlife is now gearing up to become engaged in the protection of pollinators, and this includes monarch butterflies. I think, you know, you go back to Doug Tallamy's point here, and what Doug is advocating, of course, is for native plants, and he's absolutely right. It's the native plants that feed our wildlife. And my take on that is that it's the pollinators that create the native plants. The pollinators provide the services that native plants need. You know, about 70% of that vegetation out there is pollinated by insects. And if we don't have the insects, we're not going to have the plants. So the fundamental here is that in order to keep the system connected, you have to have all these keystone players in place. And the keystone players in this particular case are your pollinators. Most people are not aware of how many small insects are involved in pollination. Most people aren't aware that there are probably 50 bee species in their immediate area that do some pollinating. There's, you know, many of these things are pretty inconspicuous. You might know honeybees, bumblebees, but that's about it. But there are a lot of other bees out there, and they're all very important, and many of them have very intimate relationships with particular plant species. And so if those pollinators aren't there, the particular plants don't get pollinated, and then they disappear because they're not producing the seeds that are needed to sustain the population. So in order to keep things together, you have to keep all the different components active in the system. And this means you've got to keep the pollinators going to keep the native plants going, and so on and so forth. So these are relationships that all ecologists kind of understand intuitively, but it's not clear that we've gotten that message out to the public. And this is why we, you know, why I go on programs like this to try to talk about this, to make it kind of clear that everything is connected out there, that we need to pay attention to those connections, because systems fall apart if you don't. I mean, we've got a history on the planet here of human populations not paying attention to the connections that sustain them, and the civilizations collapse. I'm not saying that our civilization is going to collapse, but we weaken our systems if we don't pay attention to all these connections.
That's Chip Taylor, actually Orly R. What kind of a name is Orly R?
Well, it's, Orly is a Welsh name. It's named after my father, who was the son of a Welshman. So that's where that comes from. And I've only encountered it one other time in my life. There may be other Orlies out there, but I haven't run into them.
That's why you went with Chip, huh?
That's it, yeah. Chip off the old block.
Right. Chip Taylor, he's a University of Kansas professor of ecology and evolutionary biology, founder and director of Monarch Watch. You can go to, and you really should link to Monarch Watch. Go to the website, monarchwatch.org. There's another site that I became aware of, another organization I became, and there are plenty of organizations out there helping with the monarch issue, but at the conference at the Chicago Botanic Garden earlier in the year, I became aware of Monarch Joint Venture, which is another group that folks might want to visit, go to the website and get information from all of these places. And we'll get to the idea of planting milkweed in a second, but I asked people to call in at 773-763-9278, and Ann in Chicago did, so I want to go to Ann. Good morning. You're on the Mike Novak Show.
Good morning, Mike. I've been living at my house for 29 years, and a couple years back, say about 10 or 12 years ago, I put in a white butterfly bush. And my front yard is also laden with a bunch of phlox and anything that can attract butterflies. I've had monarchs stop by for a drink. The blue butterflies, the yellow ones, little things that look more like a moth, but they're probably a butterfly as well. Because I use my front yard to attract butterflies and bees so that they go in my backyard, especially the bees, mm-hmm. to pollinate my fruits and veggies in the backyard. And it's just wonderful to see them stop by and drink from my plants.
And are you in the city of Chicago?
Yeah, I'm in Chicago. I'm in South Lakeview. I've been here 29 years. And it's just amazing because when I see a butterfly, I think to myself, which generation is this? Is he the one that's still going north, or is he the one that's going south?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think, Chip, what this points out is that even if you're in a major metropolitan area, you can make a difference by putting plants in your yard that will attract bees and butterflies, our pollinators.
Yeah, and in between, I have a couple of those milkweeds, although the neighbors look at me and say, that's nothing but a weed, and I said, but that's the stopover for the butterflies.
Well, you know what? My new branding issue is to call it a monarch plant. Don't call it milkweed. Some people say monarch weed, but I want to get the weed out of there. Because we have this prejudice against anything that's called a weed, so let's call it monarch. And I don't understand why people don't like it. It's a very exotic looking plant. It's very interesting, and it has a wonderful fragrance. It's just the association we've had for all these years. Well, Anne, thank you so much. I appreciate the work you're doing to help our butterflies.
Yeah, me too. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
773-763-9278. She brings up an interesting point, Chip, about attracting butterflies. And you mentioned, and we both mentioned Doug Tallamy, and his whole idea is put native plants in there. She mentioned butterfly bush, I believe. And that's not a native. Yet it attracts butterflies and bees. What is your feeling about having those kinds of plants available to butterflies?
Well, butterfly bush in particular is a very controversial plant because it has proven to be invasive along the East Coast and West Coast, and even in a couple of places in Kentucky. It would not be invasive in Chicago. It would not be invasive in any of the northern states. It's not invasive here in Kansas. I mean, it doesn't even begin to propagate here in Kansas.
Well, you're lucky if you can keep it alive in some of these states.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a very good nectar plant. And one of the things that we are striving for in all of this native, non-native thing is a balance because, you know, we're full of non-natives in this country. The things we eat are non-native. And we have a lot of non-native plants that have become naturalized that we don't even recognize as non-native or a problem. I mean, most of the honey that's produced in this country comes from plants that have been introduced from Europe, for example. And so we have a lot of non-natives here that are not a problem. It's the problem with the non-natives that really concerns people are the ones that become invasive, become pest species, and we have plenty of those, and those are things we need to be concerned about. And if we're really worried about buddleia along, say, the North Carolina coast, we shouldn't be planting it there. There's no question about that. So we have to be careful of what we do here. But we're looking for a balance. We're looking to provide for resources for these various species out there. And there are times when our native species don't produce very much nectar or pollen. And so it doesn't hurt to have a zinnia in your garden. It doesn't hurt to have a butterfly bush in your garden or some of these other things because they're providing resources that the native plants can't provide all the time. So, yeah, we need a balance. We need mostly natives, but a few non-natives in there are useful at many times. And we created a bird garden a couple of years ago here in Olathe, Kansas. And when you create a bird garden, you want to have something where you have seeds that the birds can use in the wintertime. You want to have berries that they can use in the wintertime and so on and so forth. And, yeah, there are a few natives that provide those things, but most of the best berry plants for birds, most of the best seed plants for birds are non-natives.
That's interesting. Although, from what I understand also, there are some fruits that birds consume, and it actually robs them of energy to try to digest them.
Yeah, I have to be careful. That's what you select, right? There's no question about that. So a little research is needed.
Yeah, that's Chip Taylor from Monarch Watch. Our telephone number is 773-763-9278. Chip, I'm going to take a short break. I want to get back to you, and I want to explore the pesticide issue. We kind of danced around it in terms of habitat, but part of what's going on here is the use of pesticides like Roundup, which is glyphosate, and what that is doing to our milkweed in the United States, and your effort to get folks to plant more milkweed. I'm honored to have on the phone with me Chip Taylor, who is the founder and director of Monarch Watch. Chip, a second ago we were talking about loss of habitat, and part of that, or at least the food that makes up, actually there's two different issues. There's the habitat issue, which is where, as you said, farmers are trying to squeeze more money out of the their crops and their land. They're unfortunately getting rid of hedgerows and that sort of thing where, we had habitat for monarchs. But the other thing that's going on is the use of herbicides, particularly Roundup or glyphosate, on the Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. In the old days, I believe you were the one, or somebody at the conference I was at the Chicago Botanic Garden, showed a photograph of a field. It was a soybean field, and there was a plant sticking up in the middle of it, and we were asked to identify it. And he said, in the old days, you would have probably said milkweed. Now, it's just a corn plant that happened to be rogue and come up in the middle of a soybean field because it's not being killed by the Roundup. But the milkweed is. Tell me about this issue.
Well, there are a number of things that are associated with glyphosate and the number of things that are going to be happening in the future. First of all, this product was first on the market about 1996, and then it really began to take off at about 2000, 2003. Then we began to see some problems with monarch butterflies. One of the issues here, the thing that we need to really clear up, is that the reason glyphosate and the reason that Roundup Ready crops have been a problem for monarch butterflies is that there used to be milkweed in those fields. Milkweed was one of the things that farmers had a difficult time getting rid of, because if you tried to use tillage to control weeds in those fields, it would chop up the plants, but they would come back. It was kind of like a sorcerer's apprentice, you know, with a little broom. You chop up the broom and it multiplies.
Yeah.
Anyway, that plant just kind of persisted out there. And it turned out in the year 2000, when a study was done about monarch habitats, that the most productive habitat turned out to be corn and soybean fields, and we were just absolutely blown over by that. We had no idea that many monarchs were produced in corn and soybean fields. Well, shortly thereafter, then the use of glyphosate increased, and it eliminated those milkweeds, and therefore there's no milkweed out there for all practical purposes. But there have been consequences of the use of this extensive amount of glyphosate. One of the things that's happened is that we now have about 16 weeds across the United States, and some of them are spreading very rapidly. I'm seeing them here in Kansas, I'm seeing them in Wisconsin and a number of other places. 16 weed species that are now tolerant of glyphosate. They've evolved a resistance to glyphosate, and these weeds are spreading rapidly, and they're causing all sorts of problems. Well, that's prompted the industry to respond by creating new types of plants that are resistant to up to four different types of herbicides. Now, not all of these are on the market yet, but the consequences of this are also of great concern. There's some other problems with glyphosate. It seems to be involved in compacting the soil if it's used extensively. And what that means is that eventually the root growth of the plants is actually restricted a bit if you overuse the glyphosate. And that means that if you restrict the root growth, you're going to restrict your crop production. So there are a number of consequences here that everybody should be concerned about. But and one of them is, going forward, what are we going to see next? If glyphosate fades out from the system, and I think it probably will, what are we going to see next? Are we going to see something that's even worse in the future? I think this is one of the things that a lot of us are worried about. We need to know a little bit more about what's going to come on the market next.
That is something that you mentioned in your talk at the Chicago Botanic Garden back in June. And something that I talked about on the show a couple of months ago was there's a move, and I think it's Dow AgroSciences wants to combine glyphosate with 2,4-D. You know, now that the glyphosate, as you said, has created these super weeds and they're hard to control, their solution is let's make something that's even more toxic and put these chemicals together. What do you think of that idea?
Well, you know, we've been in this chemical warfare with various organisms in the past, and we don't generally win chemical warfare games here with wildlife because, you know, they're capable of evolving multiple tolerances to the things that we throw at them. You know, we're seeing this with all sorts of drug resistance, right? And we're seeing this with the very pathogens that affect human beings. I mean, we now only have a few really effective antibacterial drugs because we have overused so many drugs. And so we can get infections now, which are basically untreatable, except with one or two exceptions. And we could lose those, you know. So we're in an evolutionary battle here with the weeds. If we go the chemical route, we got the beekeepers who are doing the same thing. They're trying to control mites in their colonies with chemicals. And they're trying to put chemicals in their colonies to control the mites, but don't kill the bees. And the mites are evolving resistance to these chemicals. You know, so this goes on and on and on. And we see this scenario developing in various parts of the system where we try to employ chemical solutions. We see that the organisms have got chemical solutions as well. And that makes it very difficult to see where the future is going to go in this these sorts of things, because we don't win very many of these, as I pointed out. And you've got to wonder if there has to be another solution.
But that doesn't stop these companies from trying to do this. And I think it was you, if I'm not mistaken, who said there are, what, another dozen or more chemicals in the pipeline right now that are getting ready to be rolled out, and that just, that terrifies me.
Yeah, there's about 15 different plant products, some of which are designed to resist four different types of herbicides that are being evaluated by EPA. I don't. It's been months since I followed this, so I don't know if some of them have been improved or not. But that is the concern, and so that and we're already seeing evidence that some things are resistant to multiple herbicides. So when we go back at the mosquito sort of example, and various other insects that we have thrown a lot of pesticides at, we've ended up with cases in which those organisms were resistant to multiple insecticides. And so there's no reason to expect that the plants won't do the same thing.
Let's take another quick phone call. Let's go to Lana in Des Plaines. Good morning. You're on the Mike Novak Show.
Hi, did you say my name?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say how much I'm enjoying your show and the conversation, but 2 or 3 years ago, I read Doug Tallamy. I've got a yard that's 53 by 130 feet deep, and we've planted, starting maybe 2-3 years ago, natives, plants, just as many species as I could possibly pack into the yard, including milkweeds. I've got the common milkweed and the swamp milkweed, which, by the way, does well in our yard in average soil, and the butterfly weed, and as well as many other plants. This has been a great year for us for butterflies. We've seen numerous monarchs. I actually raised one. It turned out to be a girl. I discovered the caterpillar on the common milkweed plant in back of the yard. I've seen the monarchs flit around and watch them. I believe it looks like they've laid eggs on all three species of the plants. I'm raising two more monarchs now. One just turned a couple days ago into the pupa. It's been fascinating, and I just want to say, it can make a difference. I don't use any chemicals. I've removed numerous other plants. I do have some non-natives, but I think we can all make a difference, especially if we can get parks and schools involved. And the other thing that I've wondered about is all this land that's underneath power lines that go all across the country. Why can't native plants, and I read this somewhere, I don't know, maybe it was Doug Tallamy, why can't we put natives there? But each one of us, and I don't have full sun in my yard. I've got part sun. And I've had this year monarchs, black swallowtails, eastern tiger swallowtails, both the light and the black form, commas and question marks, as well as the common cabbage butterflies. There probably have been others. Oh, the American Painted Lady, I think, earlier in the year. It's really been absolutely amazing.
Well, Lana, you're doing great work, and you actually raised a really good question, and it's a fabulous segue to the next part of this conversation. I want to thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for your show.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you. Okay. Have a great Sunday.
Bye-bye.
And she brings up a really good point, Chip, which is, how do we fight back? If we're losing 24 million acres of cropland in 5 years, and we're losing milkweed because it's being wiped out by Roundup, how do we get that back? What is, I've seen some things you've read, and it's going to require really a nationwide effort to make this happen, won't it?
Yes, that's exactly what I say on my website. I think that saving the monarch migration has to become some sort of a national priority. And so both of your callers are engaged in the right sort of thing. They're creating habitats in their own properties. And we've been trying to get people to do this since 2005. We have a program called the Monarch Way Station Program. I think we're up there with something like about 9,000 registered sites. And as your last caller brought out, we also want to get schools involved. And we have probably 800 or 900 schools involved in this Monarch Way Station program. I think we just added another 200 or 250 this year, and we've gotten support to do that. And I've just gotten a little money to put together a coordinator for that program so we can get these schools to start communicating with each other and use these as real educational resources. But in any case, we need to get everybody involved. So we need to get all the gardeners involved, and we need to use all the habitat that's out there. So your last caller talked about rights of way sort of things, power lines and gas lines and things of that sort. And these are very much on our agenda. We're trying to get the power companies involved. So there's a lot of organizations out there. I'm a member of several of them. Monarch Joint Venture is one of them, and Monarch Joint Venture has got partners which have created all sorts of educational materials for the people who are thinking about modifying rights of way areas. And, of course, we're trying to work on the DOTS, the Departments of Transportation around the country, get them to change their practices. We need to work with the railroads. We need to work with all of the park systems, both federal and state and county. And it's amazing. We can do this. I mean, I have people coming to me almost every week and saying, what can we do to help? And it looks like we're going to form quite a few partnerships that will help in this. But we need to bring everybody on board here.
Let's take another quick call. Pat, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Mike, I have a question, and then I want to tell a story, if I may. First of all, I was listening to Tom Hartman a week ago, and I was busy, so I didn't catch the beginning. But he was talking about a chemical being introduced that had a nice new name, but it was Agent Orange was the real product, marketed under something else. Do you know what that product is?
He's probably talking about what we just talked about a couple of minutes ago, which is 2,4-D. The way it works is that 2,4-D is a broadleaf weed killer. It has a cousin called 2,4-5-T, which is which kills woody plants. When you put them together, you get Agent Orange. So basically we're talking about one half of Agent Orange in 2,4-D. Chip, does that sound like what he was talking about?
I don't know the conversation, but I would assume so. There was a contaminant in that Agent Orange that
right.
created all of the problems. And if you go to the websites and you've got a strong stomach, you can see the consequences of Agent Orange still being felt in Vietnam.
Yeah, and the idea is that 2,4-D doesn't necessarily have the dioxin that Agent Orange had, and as you said, the contamination chip, but it is powerful. I mean, it's a weed killer. It kills plants, and this is it is connected to Agent Orange. 2,4-D is connected to it. It is part of that chemical, and that's I didn't hear that segment either, but that may have been what he was talking about. And what's your story, Pat?
Well, I live out in the rural area just across the state line here, and my road is a mile long. In the last 30 years, every family has had a death from cancer, all kinds of different cancers, brain, lung, breast, colon. I myself have had two cancers. Our pets have died, various things. And I've come to conclude, even though I have my well tested, it's got too much atrazine, but I think we're not keeping up with the chemicals enough to know. And I personally look at it as a gift that I'm a survivor. And I look and say, wait a minute, the common denominator has to be what the farmers are putting, not knowingly, on their crops to kill all these weeds. It's getting into the aquifer and it's spreading into our wells. And my thought is, we've got to stop this because we have such a horrendous problem. One of the cancers I had, they did ask me if I'd been exposed to Agent Orange because it was such a rare cancer. And I looked at them and said, heck no. But we are using so many chemicals. We put it on our lawns. We put it on places where our children and our pets go. We got to do something because I find that I'm a gifted person to have survived, but many of the cancers we're finding now have to be related to what we're using.
That's a very good comment, Pat, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Chip, she's got a point there, and I think part of our problem as a society and I'm speaking about the United States, is that we do not practice the precautionary principle. We create these chemicals, these herbicides. You talked about the antibiotics that, and we do it. And then look back 10 years later and say, oh, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, when we should be doing it in the first place. We should be researching these properly before we drop them on our population.
Yeah, and there's another subject which hasn't come up with regard to pesticides, and that's a group of pesticides called neonicotinamides.
Right.
Neonicotinamides are systemic insecticides that are being applied very liberally, and they've been used in most of the plants that you get in the big box stores. They're being used in an awful lot of plants around the country. They're being used on corn seeds and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of difficulty with these neonicotinamides. They're called neonics for short. Now these contaminations are showing up in water courses, and if these concentrations in water systems get to be high enough, and it's already indicated in some places that they are, they're going to eliminate aquatic invertebrates. So that means they're going to eliminate the aquatic insects and all the other invertebrate life and aquatic systems, because they're susceptible to these compounds. If that happens, then you lose your fish, you lose your fish-eating birds, and so on and so forth. Yes, you're absolutely right. Once we implement these types of things, it usually takes us 10 or 15 years to say, whoa, wait a minute, we didn't do this right. Let's turn this around. I mean, so the rhetoric we get on most of these things is very similar to what we saw with tobacco. In other words, none of the evidence that comes up showing a negative effect is accepted. It's challenged at every possible way, and this makes it very difficult in a litigation society to move this forward and to have some common sense directives here so that we're not poisoning ourselves.
Yeah, you know, the problem I have with these products is that the EPA we'll look at them. Well, there's a couple of issues here. One is that from what I understand, the EPA does not look at how chemicals react with one another. So, for instance, if you have 2,4-D and glyphosate in the same formula, they'll look at how glyphosate acts in the environment. They'll look at how 2,4-D acts in the environment, but they won't look at how they react together in the environment. And, you know, if you're a person who's on medication, you know that you have to be really careful about bringing other medicines in, because they might have an adverse reaction, the two of them together. Yet we don't look at that in our environment with the chemicals we're putting out there.
Yeah, these are called synergistic effects, and we see this already with human medication. We're seeing it in the case of the honeybee colonies that are treated with multiple chemicals. There are synergistic effects with these honeybee colonies among the different chemicals, so that the two of them together, two chemicals together, have a much stronger impact than one chemical or either chemical separately. So, this is a real issue, and this is one of the difficulties we have. We have another difficulty, and that is the EPA really doesn't have the resources to do all of the independent testing that needs to be done, and we don't have enough people outside the EPA that are doing independent testing. So largely, we have to rely on the producer of these chemicals to provide the data.
And sure, they're going to tell you that when used according to label directions, they're perfectly safe. This is the line that often comes out of these companies. They're the ones doing the testing, not the EPA, as you say, because EPA doesn't have the staff to do this or the money. And then these chemical companies say, don't worry, they're perfectly safe when used within or used by if you follow the label directions. Welcome to the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. We are talking to Chip Taylor, who is the founder and director of Monarch Watch. Chip, last winter was not good for the monarchs. They go to Mexico to overwinter. Tell us about the numbers there and what you're seeing this summer in the United States.
Well, Mike, and to your listeners, last year we saw the third decline in a row. We've had this population decline 3 years in a row, and for each of the last several years, we've been able to predict which direction the population would go as early as May, because we kind of looked at all of the data in the spring, and it kind of helps us get a pretty good grip on what the population is going to do. And we watch very carefully what happens in Texas, and then we watch what happens in Oklahoma and Kansas, and then through the summer months, and it gives us a pretty good handle on what's going to happen. So we knew the population was going to be down last year, and it was. It was the lowest that had ever been seen. It was very, very sad. There were really a tremendous number of concerned people in Mexico, concerned tourists, concerned all over the monarch community about the low numbers of monarchs that arrived in Mexico last winter. Fortunately, the conditions this spring were much better than they were each of the last three springs, and the butterflies are on the route to make a rebound. Just how much of an increase they're going to make is not clear. But what we're getting is positive reports from all over the country, and we pretty much forecast all of that. We did forecast all of that as early as May based on temperatures, based on what we were seeing in Texas, based on how fast the butterflies moved into the upper Midwest and the breeding areas. And it's looked good ever since. We were worried that we would have a really cold summer, and if we had a really cold summer, that would slow things down and reduce the population. But summer is more or less normal, a little cold in some places, but not too cold for the butterflies. And so it looks like the populations have developed well. We're going to see good butterfly populations from the eastern Dakotas right through southern Michigan. The East Coast is going to be a little bit better than it was last year. Not great, but a little bit better. Through the Ohio Valley, we're getting pretty good reports. Through northern Illinois, we're getting good reports. Iowa, we haven't had very many reports from, but we're seeing a lot of monarchs here in Kansas, more than we've seen in each of the last 2 years. So things are looking good. The population is going to rebound. Just how big it's going to be, it's not clear, but it'll still be a small population by historical standards.
Yeah, when you tell people that that the population is doing better, it's not time to say, "Wow, we fixed that problem and move on." We still need to address it.
Oh yeah, this is the best I think we can see is a doubling of the population. We may get a doubling. We may even get a little bit better than that. That doubling would still be one of the all-time low numbers. But it would indicate that the butterflies can make a rebound, and we know they can. We just have to have the habitat for them. And right now the concern is, we're still losing habitat. We're losing habitat at a rate of 1 to 2 million acres a year, and we've got to address that. So one of the things that people can see if they go to our website is that they can see that I've written up something called the Monarch Recovery Plan. And the Monarch Recovery Plan says, if we want to move ahead and maintain this population, we have to address the issue of the amount of habitat we're losing every year. And that means we have to replace, we have to restore enough milkweed monarch habitat to compensate for the loss of 1 to 1.5 million acres of habitat every year.
And you want people to plant milkweed, and that's another thing that you've been working very hard on at Monarch Watch. And if they go to the website, again, it's monarchwatch.org. What can they find out about milkweed?
Well, they can go to the milkweed market, and if we don't have the milkweeds for them, they can find a local nursery that has them. We worked with a nursery here, and we started this program last year, and I didn't know that it would work. We asked the nurseryman to produce 25,000 milkweeds, and as I tell people, I think I was pretty optimistic, thinking I could sell 25,000 milkweed plugs. But we sold 22,000 of them in the first year, and this year our goal was 40,000, and we've already sold 54,000, and we're still selling them. So I'm not sure whether we've got milkweeds available for the northern Illinois area, but we have them available for some parts of the country, and we're going to have a lot for next spring. So if your listeners are interested in getting involved in this crusade, have them contact us and start thinking about what they can do to plant milkweeds next spring, and we'll produce the milkweeds for the northern Illinois area.
Chip Taylor, thank you so much. He's the founder and director of Monarch Watch. Again, go to monarchwatch.org. You can find all that information. I hope folks will do that, and we'll keep an eye on things, and maybe in 6 months or so, we'll talk again and see what's happening.
All right, Mike. It was nice chatting with you.
It's great chatting with you, and thank you for doing the whole hour. It flew by for me, and I know you're a busy guy, and you just got back in the town, so go take a nap.
Yeah, well, stay cool, Mike.
All right.